we can't make those trees grow any faster. That's our problem.
Well, part of it is to also develop new markets for the second growth.
Senator Murkowski spars with the head of the Forest Service over the plan for the Tongass. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, mushers rest and strategize at the Nikolai checkpoint on the Iditarod Trail.
I'm going to tiptoe this dog team to Takotna like I usually do and see what I've got. I think that's a good thing to figure out before you start pressing the heck out of them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Elder Mentor Program is about sharing the wisdom and culture of Alaskan elders in classrooms and communities across Alaska. Elders age 55 and older bring storytelling and modeling of appropriate behavior to the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting educational professionals and children. Alaska's elder mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Governor Bill Walker named Ivy Sponholz today as his choice to fill the vacancy caused by the death of Representative Max Gruenberg in February. Sponholz is the development director for Salvation Army Alaska and is the vice chairwoman of the Alaska Children's Trust, which aims to eliminate childhood abuse and neglect throughout the state. Sponholz says she wanted the job to address the state's budget shortfall. Her goal is to avoid economic problems the state experienced in the 1980s. She says when she was a teenager, her parents divorced and her family faced financial strains.
I don't want to ever go through that again, and I wanted to be a part of the conversation in hopes that we can start thinking about the Alaska that we want to have and, you know, not just the Alaska that, is convenient for us to pay for.
Sponholz was one of three people nominated by Anchorage Democrats for the position. The House Democrats are scheduled to vote on her appointment either tonight or tomorrow morning. A spokesman for the caucus says she's unlikely to face any opposition. She says her first job is to learn about the budget proposals put forward by Walker and legislators. She'll also put her experience to work.
Right now I work for the Salvation Army, and we see those that are most vulnerable. I'm going to be able to, to bring that experience and the knowledge of, what our most vulnerable, elders and youth are facing every day when we're making decisions about, how to chart a course forward.
Walker says he was impressed with the choices that Sponholz has made, including her founding an organization, Foster Kids First, and her family's decision to adopt a child who has fetal alcohol syndrome.
Also, the life experiences of her personal story of going through the 80s, what Alaska experienced during the 80s and the downturn of oil. She, in many respects, that was somewhat similar, although without the loss of life, to what I had been through after the 64 earthquake.
Walker says it was a difficult choice. He praised the other nominees, scientist Taylor Brelsford, and legislative staff member Kendra Kloster. While he says he could have taken more time, he wanted to make sure District 16 was represented. Republican Don Hadley is the only other candidate who's announced plans to run for the seat this fall. The filing deadline for the primary is June 1st. The National Forest Service is working on a controversial plan to shift the timber industry in the Tongass away from old-growth trees. This morning in Washington, the head of the Forest Service insisted the gradual transition to younger trees can sustain Southeast Alaska's timber industry. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell said it several different ways the plan will work.
Without any question, I believe this approach that over time to transition to the young growth is the solution to be able for us to continue to provide that integrated wood products industry in Southeast Alaska.
Tidwell faced skeptical questions from Senator Lisa Murkowski in the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which she chairs. Murkowski pointed out that the Forest Service hasn't done an inventory of the newer stands to gauge commercial viability.
So the question this morning is whether or not the Forest Service will consider postponing this transition until we have a complete young growth inventory and a financial analysis that are completed in order to determine whether or not a transition is even feasible.
Senator, it's essential that we move forward and complete the amendment to the forest plan.
Tidwell is under orders from the Agriculture Secretary to expedite the Tongass transition. The Forest Service is preparing an amendment to its Tongass management plan by the end of the year, before time runs out on the Obama administration. Chief Tidwell's answer to Murkowski was basically no. They can't delay the transition while they gather data and complete reports on the timber inventory.
2 decades of controversy and litigation around old growth harvest and roadless. And that's gotten us nowhere.
I understand that. But this you still have to know that it is possible to get to a second growth because we can't make those trees grow any faster. That's our problem.
Well, part of it is to also develop new markets for the second growth. And we're working together with Sea Alaska, with Mental Health Trust.
New markets are good, Chief, but you still have to have trees that are mature enough to harvest.
Tidwell and Murkowski have had this argument at past hearings, too. He says the Forest Service will continue sales of old growth to serve as bridge timber during the transition. The senator told him her constituents on Prince of Wales Island and elsewhere in Southeast believe the plan is unrealistic. Watching the hearing was another group of Murkowski's constituents, a small contingent of Southeast Alaska fishermen and guides organized by Trout Unlimited. They came to Washington seeking protection for 73 areas of the Tongass they say are the most valuable habitat for salmon. Austin Williams, who works for the Alaska branch of Trout Unlimited, says he hopes the Forest Service preserves those areas in its amendment to the Tongass Plan, and he doesn't want the process halted while the government counts and measures the younger timber stands.
We have an opportunity to get this plan amendment through in a way that provides some protection for high-value fish watersheds, and we shouldn't delay that out of concern for, the inventory at this point.
Trout Unlimited and other conservation groups have been campaigning to protect this collection of watersheds, what they call the Tongass 77, for several years. They haven't changed the campaign moniker, even after 4 watersheds on their list were removed from the Tongass in 2014 in the Sea Alaska Land Bill. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a shortage of assisted living homes in Southeast means some older residents have to leave the region.
That's the last thing we want to have happen in our community is to send our loved ones outside. They want to age here and they want to die here.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
The largest tribal government in Southeast Alaska now has authority over foster care and other services for Native children facing abuse or neglect. An agreement signed last week transfers state management as well as funding to the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Central Council, which is headquartered in Juneau, lists more than 30,000 tribal members in and outside of the state. But tribal children removed from their parents due to abuse or neglect are often placed in non-Native homes. Council President Richard Peterson says Native children have a better chance in life if they know their heritage. He says those separated from their extended families and cultures have a harder time.
A lot of us don't know who we are. We don't know how we fit into this modern society that has grown up around us. But I am ever so grateful that we're taking steps forward, steps that are going to heal those wounds, that are going to put our families back together.
The council says about 2/3 of all Southeast children in state custody are Alaska Native or American Indian. Peterson says his tribal organization's cultural understanding will make it easier to work with parents and increase the number of Native foster homes. The agreement puts the Central Council in charge of temporary foster care placement until children can safely return home. If that can't happen, it will find permanent homes with relatives or through adoption. The tribe also takes over state programs addressing underlying causes of abuse and neglect among Native families, and it will support children placed with relatives who become guardians or adoptive families. The council has had control and funding of some other state social service programs in Southeast for more than a decade. Alaska Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson says this transfer is long overdue.
This agreement really takes it to a whole new level. By extending child welfare and tribal court services, including extensive case management, foster home licensing, financial support for tribal foster homes, and a whole host of other services.
The agreement is modeled after a 2013 compact with Interior Alaska's Tanana Chiefs Conference. The Tlingit-Haida Central Council and other tribal governments have sought such authority for years, but they've met opposition from some state officials, among others. Davidson says it's time to return control.
This truly is a government-to-government agreement that recognizes that tribes are uniquely and supremely and ultimately qualified to be able to meet the needs of tribal families.
The Council's Peterson says it's also time for tribal organizations to provide more services to people they best understand.
I'm a major proponent of our sovereignty, our tribal sovereignty, and building upon our tribal courts and our programs like this, this is us being sovereign. Putting our families back together is being sovereign.
The agreement was signed during a March 2nd ceremony at the Elizabeth Paratovich Hall in downtown Juneau. I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Dallas Seavey has surged to the front of the Iditarod pack between Nikolai and McGrath. The defending race champion dropped one dog and rested 4 hours in Nikolai, about 250 miles into the race. His father, Mitch Seavey, and Wade Mars are following closely behind as of 4 p.m. this afternoon, according to the Iditarod Inside GPS tracker. Pete Kaiser and Allie Zirkel round out the front pack. Brent Sass blew through the Nikolai checkpoint this morning without stopping and was the first to leave, while Noah Burmeister stopped only for half an hour. Nicholas Petit arrived first in the Kuskokwim village and logged a six-hour break. The race is approaching the traditional locations for a mandatory 24-hour layover. Nikolai was bustling all day as dog teams pulled in and out of the sixth checkpoint. As KNOM's Emily Schwing reports, it's a turning point in the race. Teams have passed over some of the roughest trail. From here, mushers will evaluate their dogs as they try to decide how best to execute their race plans.
There's a flu going around on the Iditarod Trail, and Dallas Seavey has it.
I think I'm getting better, though. But these first couple days have been unpleasant, to say the least.
But Seavey isn't looking back. As he scarfed a bowl of chicken soup in Nikolai's school cafeteria, he was trying to figure out his next move.
This is a pretty major turning point in the race. What we do out of here will determine, you know, where we end up taking our 24. So I've got to make that decision. And I'm not sure where the destination is yet.
Mushers have to take a mandatory 24-hour layover somewhere along the trail. Seavey's team is a mix of experienced veterans and a few young dogs he describes as monsters. He says he's trying to figure out where to take his rest to maximize what they can do.
It would be a very, very, very safe move for me to just go over to Tikotna and take my 24. But I don't know that that's the best thing for the team. So I'm trying really hard just to run the team by what I know a team should look like coming into the 24, even if that means pushing them a little harder than I've ever had to push a team to get them to look like that. But, you know, these are good problems, so we'll figure it out.
Aside from the good kind, problems mushers are dealing with include banged up bodies and shredded runner plastic. Outside of Roan, there's roughly 15 miles of snowless trail through an area decimated by wildfire. In 2014, that trail ended a number of races, so mushers were a little leery heading into this year's race.
Nothing like 2 years ago, so I guess we can't.
Allie Zirkel made a snack for her dogs as they rested in the sun.
It still was a little, still definitely is mushing on dirt. The dogs are like some, like your dog running down the trail in the summer. It's like, woohoo, this is great. And the mushers are, actually I got cramps in my arms. Just kind of making sure I didn't let go at the wrong time.
Frozen dirt, no snow at all, rougher than a cob.
That was Paul Gebhardt's experience through the burn. This is his 20th Iditarod.
Where there was a little bit of snow, then it would glaciate. But it would glaciate side hill down towards the trees, so your sled's constantly trying to... I wiped out two big trees, but I didn't break my sled, I don't think.
Gebhardt says that run's never gone smoothly for him.
I've not had a good run to Nikolai in 10 years.
And this year?
Nope, I carried three dogs. I've carried dogs every time for the last 10 years. So it's like, I can't break that jinx. I don't know what it is. It's just, it's really rough trail out there. You know, it takes a toll.
His next step is to figure out what kind of rest his team needs and where they need it most.
I mean, I'm set up that I can do it wherever, but I would like to get to the river. I don't know if these guys will bounce back after a nice rest here or not. A lot of it will depend on what they look like when I get to Tecotna.
Some mushers will opt to hunker down at the next checkpoint in McGrath for a long rest. Others may gamble and continue on as far as Ruby, the halfway point in the race, where the trail meets the Yukon River. As for Allie Zirkel, she says she plans to play it safe. She was on her way to grab some water for her dog team.
I'm going to tiptoe this dog team to Tecotna like I usually do and see what I've got. I think that's good thing to figure out before you start pressing the heck out of them.
On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing.
Howdy.
In Nikolai.
Hi, it's always good to see your smile.
Well, I'll give it to you then.
Okay, hey, that's a good one.
May I have some hot water?
We got, yeah.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Due to a shortage of assisted living homes, some of Southeast Alaska's aging residents can't stay in their home communities. Facilities in Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, and Petersburg provide assistance to seniors needing help with daily activities. As part of the Coast Alaska series, Aging Southeast, Lisa Fu reports the region isn't keeping up with demand for assisted living, and that demand is only expected to grow.
On a recent Tuesday morning, Jackie Farnsworth and Jack Brandt play piano and sing at the state-run Juneau Pioneers Home. A number of residents seated in a semicircle of couches and chairs in front of the piano join in. They have music stands in front of them so they can follow along. A few play maracas. Down the hall, Irene Cashin sits in a recliner watching TV. The 87-year-old moved in last March and doesn't miss living alone.
Look at me. I have my room over there, and I do beading. I can do things by myself. I can come over here in my lounge and watch news and go out in the other room, and there's always something.
Group activities scheduled for later that day include a history talk, card games, exercise called Fun and Fit, and more music. Cashin can join in or do her own thing.
I made up my own mind to come in because I know I have beginning Alzheimer's and I know about it. And I don't want my children to have to take care of me at home. I can take care of myself here, and it's been a wonderful experience.
Cashin has spent almost her whole life in Juneau. Kids, grandkids, great-grandkids also live here. It's where she wants to remain, and the home means she can. That's not the case for many of Southeast Alaska's senior citizens. The demand outweighs supply, and many communities in the region don't offer any assisted living options. The region's geography and its rapidly aging population create challenges that don't exist in more populated parts of the state.
We're not connected. So if somebody from Prince of Wales needs help, they're basically giving up their home and having to move and may never go back.
Dee Wright runs The Manor in Ketchikan, the only licensed assisted living home in Southeast run by a private individual. She says some of its dozen residents are from Prince of Wales Island, Metlakatla, Sitka, and Juneau. She says people who can't find placement in Southeast often have to leave.
There are people up north and down south that could come home if we have the housing.
Haines and Petersburg also have assisted living homes, and Sitka and Ketchikan have pioneers homes. Altogether, they house about 210 older adults. All have long waiting lists. Julie Sandy is the administrator at the Ketchikan Pioneers Home.
The calls that I'm fielding at this point, I'm saying to people, if you haven't applied to the Pioneer Home and, you know, you're 86 years old and you need to move in right now, there's the possibility that I will not be able to serve you in your lifetime. And that's very hard to say, you know, for individuals who just get on the wait list, it can be years before they move to the top of my list.
In Juneau, a nonprofit is working to build a new assisted living community to meet some of the need. Senior Citizens Support Services Incorporated President Sue Douglas is among those tired of seeing people leave because of the shortage of assisted living options.
That's the last thing we want to have happen in our community is to send our loved ones outside. They want to age here and they want to die here.
Douglas expects residents to come from all over Southeast, with most from Juneau. She says the nonprofit has secured land in Vintage Park in Juneau's populous Mendenhall Valley, close to amenities. The project would have about 90 apartment-like units with a projected monthly cost between $5,000 and $7,000. One of the major hurdles is finalizing the financing. Douglas says it would cost up to $30 million.
The biggest message to the people in Southeast Alaska right now is just knowing and feeling confident that this project will get completed. We will do this. We'll have it available.
And I did this one flat.
Back at the Juneau Pioneers Home, Irene Cashin says she's happy she chose to move into assisted living. Her mother had lived in the Pioneers Home in Sitka, so she knew it was a good option. And she thinks others will make a similar choice, if they can.
It's fun. You know, it's real life. And it's still your life. You're not taking away from your own children's life, you know. I see them as much as I did before, and they don't have to worry about me.
A new assisted living community in Juneau could be complete as soon as fall 2017. The Manor in Ketchikan also hopes to build a new assisted living home that could house up to 28 people. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Last week, NPR Music announced the winner of its second-ever Tiny Desk concert, Duluth, Minnesota's Galen Lee. More than 6,000 hopeful bands and solo musicians submitted videos of their work for a chance to play NPR Music's coveted Tiny Desk at headquarters in Washington, D.C. Though there can only be one winner, KTOO's Kira Alkima interviewed some of the standout Alaska performers who competed for the title.
A little less than solid, huh?
Illuminated by a single light, a four-piece band sets up inside the wheelhouse of a fishing boat moored in Juneau's Harris Harbor.
We're Goldwing, and this is a fisherman's desk.
Goldwing singer and primary songwriter Dan Kirkwood fronts the band that competed in NPR Music's video competition to discover the next great performer to play the Tiny Desk.
You end up with one light, a little light just above the helm. You can see that it's a gray day in Juneau. You can see the kind of the forward-leaning windows of the wheelhouse, and the actual helm feels like Juneau.
And the fisherman's desk? That's part of the contest rules. All videos must take place at a desk, any desk, emulating Bob Boylan's in D.C., where the actual Tiny Desk lives. Since 2008, Boylan's desk has been host to nearly 500 intimate performances, from Yo-Yo Ma and Death Cab for Cutie to Adele. Goldwing is one of 25 Alaska bands that competed in the contest this year, with more than 6,000 acts nationally. The winner will tour the country, appear on the NPR program Ask Me Another, and of course, play a Tiny Desk concert. From Bethel to Fairbanks, Anchorage to the Big Island of Hawaii, bands showcase their original songs written in and inspired by The Last Frontier. For second-year contestants Emma Hill and Brian Dast, the contest was about overcoming geographic distance to create the video for their song, A Long Way to Run. With Hill in Hawaii and Dast in Oregon during the submission period, recording together meant that Dast taught himself to use green screen technology to create the illusion of performing in the same place.
No matter what we did, it was gonna probably come off as a little wacky, just wanting to do it anyway, just for fun. And honestly, mostly so that Brian could have fun playing around with green screen.
Anchorage-based musician Hannah Yoder saw the contest as an opportunity to make a video for one of her newer songs, A Million Tears. Her five-piece ensemble recorded the song in a band member's office with the help of a tech-savvy friend.
It's really nice to not only have audio, but to actually have a video where you can watch the band and you can see them playing, and just to kind of have something that's more than just like a, you know, an iPhone video at a concert.
And with plans to record a full-length album in April, the band's already getting a response from NPR's national audience.
And after we posted the video, we were contacted by multiple people about multiple gigs, people we've never met before. The NPR tag on it makes it available to a broader spectrum of folks. It's getting a lot of exposure to places that we never thought it would. There's only so far you can go, really, in Alaska.
Though the path from Alaska to the Tiny Desk in D.C. is still long, the contest brought 25 Alaskan artists a little closer. In Juneau, I'm Kira Alkema.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We have reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Lisa Fu, Ed Schoenfeld, and Kira Akuma in Juneau, and Emily Schwing in Nikolai on the Iditarod Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deedline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.